Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Damn. Tanya, how are you? All right?
Not too bad, thank you.
Okay, Tanya Sweeney is here for a good reason, because it was 20 years ago today. I won't sing a song. Okay, anyway, it was 20 years ago, this very day actually, when a particular album was released, which will become in time an iconic album. I'm referring to the late Jeff Buckley's Grace from 1994. Since its release then, it's been named the number one modern rock classic of all time by Mojo magazine, listed as one of Rolling Stone magazine's greatest all-time albums. Not only that, it featured on Enemy's best album list, while Jeff Buckley's name constantly features on lists of all-time greatest singers. Grace was Buckley's debut album and basically the only complete studio album that he released before he met an untimely death while swimming in the Mississippi River. Here now to talk about the album is the aforementioned Tanya Sweeney, and about the life and times of Jeff Buckley, and basically you're writing about it today in The Independent, Tanya, so spew it out to us right now. Tell us, first of all, goodness a me. Fan.
I was, of course, how could you not be a fan of Jeff Buckley? I mean, I think I was in college when this album came out, and I'm a huge believer that anything you like when you're 17, you'll bring through life. But
absolutely.
I mean, Grace came, you know, around the time of, you know, the grunge era. It was the end of the grunge era. Over here, we had baggy and Britpop, you know, so everything was sort of still, you know, quite vibrant. This just cut through everything. It was just unbelievable. It was so celestial. And Jeff Buckley was this sort of singer who, like, he was so, not effeminate, but I mean, he was such an antidote to that sort of grungy, hair metal sort of macho posturing, you know. And I mean, it helped that he was pretty as well.
It spoke to you as a fae student, did it?
As a fae and lovelorn student, I'm sure it did. Yeah, I mean, I don't remember hearing anything like that. I mean, you hear about singer-songwriters and they were all fairly sort of monotonous maybe at the time. And this guy had taken so many different influences. I mean, Edith Piaf, Nina Simone, you know.
Well, most singer-songwriters seem to be kind of saying something incredibly important, or supposedly anyway, about the human condition. Whereas this guy was just grooving in the stratosphere.
Do you know the funny thing? This is what's sort of added into the mythology. Jeff Buckley talked an awful lot about mortality and how, you know, love saved him from a fear of mortality. And of course, when he died at the age of 30, the album took on this entirely new meaning. It was a real shame that became the legacy behind Grace, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was very well reviewed when it came out first, but it wasn't exactly the kind of, you know, I suppose you can't be iconic by the end of the year, but you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, okay, this is a guy who, he was finding his feet at the time. You know, he'd been in a number of sort of jazz and reggae and funk bands. You know, he was still finding his feet. There was three covers on that album as well. You know, meaning showing that, you know, he had yet to sort of really find his true voice. But whatever was his on that album was absolutely incredible.
Okay, well then let's take a look. Who is Jeff Buckley?
Who was Jeff Buckley? Well, Jeff Buckley was a young man from Anaheim in California. His father, of course, was Tim Buckley, who was a 60s sort of folk troubadour, you know. And Jeff was always very keenly aware of the sort of, you know, the connotations of being 60s folk offspring. He ran from it as far as he could. I think Tim Buckley's manager wanted to manage him and he just said, no, no way. And he went up to New York. He did the hard graft, you know, up there. He played in Chennai. And he played in a lot of coffee houses and a lot of small bars, you know.
Well, let's take a look. You mentioned Sinead. Let's take a look at the Irish roots of Jeff Buckley.
I mean, there's so many of them. I mean, he used to be Glenn Hansard's sound technician on the Commitments tour in 1991. So, and he was friends with, you know, singers like Mark Geary. He did play regularly in Sinead, which was co-owned by Mark Geary's brother, Carl. So, I mean, and I think Jeff Buckley always spoke. I mean, Tim Buckley's grandfather was from Cork and he always spoke about that Irish connection, you know, and how he felt he had that sort of Irish heart.
He was a hedge school teacher in Cork.
You that know. Was it. He was a hedge master, exactly.
A long, long time ago, indeed.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so like, I mean, he was on the Commitments tour. He was playing as well as being a guitar thing. And he was a good friend of Glenn's, wasn't he?
He was a good friend of Glenn's. And, you know, I always thought, you know, in the years since, you know, and as I've watched Glenn's career unfold, that's probably the sort of career that Jeff Buckley would have loved to have had. Unfortunately, he fell in with Columbia Records and it all, you know.
are you blaming Columbia for his death, is that
well, let's not. Oh, gosh, no. I mean, the thing about Columbia, though, is Columbia were one of the labels that were great at engendering really long, album-rich careers. Yeah. You know, there's Dylan, Springsteen, Billie Holiday, you know, so it was a great fit for him. But they did see that they had this sort of Aladdin's cave on their hands, you know, and as soon as Grace was released, you know, I mean, I think Columbia definitely saw this sort of cash cow, you know, rolling through the door, you know. And I mean, I think what happened was the follow-up to Grace, there was three or four different sessions. He kept, you know, delivering demos to Columbia and they didn't work, you know. And I mean, they really wanted to turn him into a pop star. I mean, there was a song on Grace called Forget Her, which is incredible, very radio friendly. But Jeff pulled it from the album, you know, because he kind of knew that this was going to catapult him into the big leagues. And it just wasn't a place he wanted to go, you know.
All right. By the way, just on the Tim Buckley thing, rather than just dismiss him as a sort of a famous folky kind of thing, it was more than that in some ways. Like, he's had about 9 or 10 albums, some of which are absolutely brilliant.
He was incredibly prolific.
I think people even from the 90s would know one of his songs very well, Songs of the Siren by, what do you call them, This Mortal Coil and that, which is
absolutely
one he wrote.
And I wouldn't reduce Tim Buckley's legacy for one second, but at the same time, Jeff Buckley met him once when he was 8 years old, you know. So, you know,
he didn't really know his father.
Estranged
is probably the nicest word I could use. Yeah,
that's exactly it.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. So Columbia Records anyway was there, and they released this one album. The fact that he only has one real album on release, doesn't that kind of add to it all?
Well, this is exactly it. I mean, it's
the same way, like, as Paul McCartney is often vilified and John Lennon is deified in some ways, like, you know, because Paul forgot to get shot dead at 40. Sorry, but like, in one way, like, that's kind of like, you know, these things add up to a picture that
maybe is
a little bit rose tinted glasses.
Sort of an only the good die young kind of a thing. And I mean, unfortunately, what happened when Jeff Buckley died is, I mean, I think if you look onto Spotify now or somewhere, you're going to find 8 versions of Grace. You're going to find imports. You're going to find legacy editions live, you know, every single scrap of anything that he recorded ended up out there, you know. And I mean, Dan Hegarty and I were having this conversation in the week while I was writing the piece, you know. I think personally it's sort of, you know, lessened the legacy a little bit, you know, because what musician wants their sort of scraps and their demos knocking around?
Certainly,
you know?
I would have thought Jeff Buckley would not be the type who would like that to have happened.
Yeah,
and that, of course, wouldn't have happened if he had continued to release albums.
Well, exactly, you know. But yeah. And I mean, when I spoke to Daphne Brooks, who was one of his biographers, you know, for the piece as well, and she did speak with Jeff's mother, Mary, and, you know, Mary just wanted to put that music out there for the fans. And, you know, she was trying very hard to be very sort of caring towards that legacy. So, I mean, the opinion is divided on whether it was a good idea or not to release everything.
I never met Jeff Buckley, but I did, bizarrely, I saw him twice live.
There you go.
In Dublin. He played 3 times here. I never saw the first one. He played in Trinity College at the Ball.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, I know, in 92 or something like that. And he had great stories to tell about that, but I didn't see that. But I did see him 2 times in 94, twice in the space of about 3 or 4 months. Once in Whelan's and once at the Tivoli.
Right. Well, the Whelan's one was the launch album for Grace, actually.
I'm not 100% sure of that, because the Whelan's one didn't seem very launchy to me. I mean, to be honest, first of all, I don't think there was anybody upstairs. And you know Whelan's where you look over.
Oh, I do.
And even downstairs there was room. And he was brilliant. He played a plugged in electric guitar. He had no band with them or anything. But he really was great. But about 4 months later, I saw him at the Tivoli and it was a disaster. Well, it wasn't a disaster. The whole gig was a mess. The lights were all on. And at one stage, he called Cathal Kinnick up to play and she had to climb over the blinking. It was all a mess. The gig wasn't set up right in any way at all.
And was it a full band at the Tivoli or?
Jeepers, you know, I remember he brought Cathal up. That's all I can remember. I can't remember. Don't know. Yeah. Anyway, that was only a few months later. And I think that was the launch night of the
album. Well, I mean, the thing is, the Whelan show was 20 years this weekend. So it coincided with the release date of the album. So, I mean, I'm not sure it was a Columbia Records, you know, shindig or anything like that.
Well, he was great. There's no doubt about it at Whelan's that night. Anyway, listen, let's just take a look at this then. So the Irish connection is those gigs that he would have played and the fact that his grandfather was Cork and the Shinné you mentioned as well, which I'm going to get to in a second because I want to talk to somebody about that as well. Just tell me about something he did or didn't do afterwards. What came out? I mean, like, I know when he died, he was making an album. I think he had done some sessions with Tom Verlaine from television
and
they did not work out at all. He just didn't get on with Tom Verlaine,
this
I think,
is
which
exactly
is terrible because Tom's a bit of a genius.
Well, this was the thing, and this was why, you know, he was down in Mississippi, you know, and he was getting increasingly
frustrated. This is 1997.
1997, yeah. May 1997. And he was down in Mississippi and getting increasingly frustrated. And obviously there was, you know, an element of difficult second album syndrome, you know, weighing heavily on his mind, you know. But so unfortunately, he waded into the Wolf River in Mississippi.
There's always been a huge story about that. I remember in 97 he waded in, he had his boots on, he had his clothes on, he was trying to swim supposedly from one side to the other.
Yeah.
What's this about wading into the bloody Mississippi?
The account that I've read is that, you know, a boat went past and made some waves,
the wash,
and you know, his friend turned, you know, away from the water to sort of move a sound system away from the waves, turned back, and Jeff was nowhere to be found, you know. So it was horribly tragic. I mean, the funny thing about it though was I his death completely passed me by because I was finishing up. This was pre-internet, you know, or the internet was in its infancy. So I only found out about his death about 3 weeks later. I'd moved to New York by this stage and I opened up the Village Voice and there was this big sort of dissective forensic piece on Jeff Buckley.
Which shows you it wasn't exactly front page stuff.
Well, this was exactly it. Yeah, it wasn't at all. So. Right.
Okay, I'm going to play a piece now. Like, I mean, just in case people often think, and they can build this up now, that he was some kind of a troubled fallen angel kind of thing. He wasn't like that. He wasn't really like that. He was a typical bloke.
No, he was fairly typical, you know. And I mean, the only thing was, I think he was just a little bit startled at how, you know, how quick the trajectory was and what Columbia were trying to do with him. But he was by no means a fallen angel.
Talking about this weekend, 20 years ago, the album Grace was released. It's the really only one proper studio thingamabob released from certainly in his lifetime. And this is a track from it. It's called Last Goodbye. That is music, of course, from Jeff Buckley. Grace is the name of the album. By the way, fans of Jeff Buckley and his work will know that Jeff Buckley himself had very close ties to Sinn Éi, an Irish cafe stroke kind of club stroke pub on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It was here that Jeff Buckley first started performing and would later record an album there called Live at Sinn Éi. So how did the relationship between Buckley and the Sinn Éi club come about? Well, Shane Doyle was the owner of Sinn Éi at the time and who gave Jeff Buckley his break. Shane on the phone now. Welcome to the programme. Shane, tell me first of all about what was and where was Sinn Éi.
It was on 8th Street between 1st Avenue and Avenue A, the Lower East Side.
And what was it? I just mentioned there that it was a club, it was a pub.
It was just a little cafe. It was like a little oasis in the middle of something else. I mean, there was an anarchist bookstore up the street and the homeless people were living in Tompkins Square Park down on the other side. And there was a lot of derelict buildings down there at that time. And for some reason or other, I decided it'd be a good place to open a coffee shop. And that then turned into a music place.
Okay, so it was opened by you and Carl Geary at the very end of the 1980s or so. Jeff Buckley, 1993, does a recording of him 10 years later in 2003, direction called Live at Sinn Éi or whatever. Just tell me about him coming in. I mean, like, how important was he to Sinn Éi? Was he the most important musician that would have played there?
In hindsight, yeah. At the time, it wasn't like that. I used to have people play residencies. I had Tom Clark, he did Mondays. Adam Rapp did Tuesdays. The National Wrecking Company Thursdays. Anyway, Jeff got the Monday night. And your gig started at 8 o'clock, and it could go to 10 or 11 or 12 or 2 in the morning, whatever, depending on what happened and who showed up, you know? And He would come in and he did a lot of cover songs back then, and it was all very experimental, you know. He'd be reaching for a note or something and he wouldn't make it, and then he'd break off into a Tom Waits song, and he did great impersonations of people, you know. He could do Bob Dylan and I can't remember off the top of my head, but loads of people. And then it depends on who showed up, you know, like Marianne Faithfull might show up, Cattell Koenig, the Hot House Flowers. He'd play with anybody. And he did. And that's how the nights developed down there.
Yeah, I get the impression. I get the impression with Jeff Buckley when he was in Sinn Éi, he was learning as much live on stage and using it as almost a kind of a cool rehearsal as he was putting on a proper concert or performance.
Absolutely. That's what it was. Then everything changed all of a sudden. You know, I'd get these phone calls from like Seymour Stein's office or Clive Davis's office, and they want to book a table for 8 or 10 people. And I always said, yes, sure, of course. But the place didn't cater to that. And they would come down in their limousines and he would play an amazing show. But then when they left, he played the best show ever. He played for a couple of hours afterwards and all the pressure was off him, and he could do that, you know. He could just meander from one song into another, or he could just stop in the middle and, you know, he'd give you a monologue about whatever. And he was very at ease like that. So, you know, that was a big change, but he still kept playing there. And even after they did the Live at Sinn Éi, and I think they did that specifically because they didn't want to elevate him to, you know, the spotlight straight away. They wanted him to feel comfortable with what he was doing. So that's how that came about.
Just speaking of Sinn Éi itself, you mentioned Marianne Faithfull. I mean, Allen Ginsberg, Gabriel Byrne, Johnny Depp, like, they all came by for what? To play? To get up on stage or just to have a cup of coffee?
If I could get them to do something, they would. And a lot of them did. I kind of just facilitated the thing. It just became a place. I don't know. To be honest with you, when I went to work there at nighttime, I was as excited as anybody to know who was going to show up. I had no idea. People would call up and say to me, Shane McGowan playing there tonight. I go, well, no, why would you say that? And they go, no, he was at the airport. Yeah. And sure enough, he'd come by, you know, or whoever. Yeah. So it was like that. It became a place where if anybody was in town, they came by. And you know, the Gabriel Barnes and Terry George, people like that came by, Jim Sheridan. They all came by. They did readings. They did all kinds of things.
Yeah, and you two came by. You two came by in a limo, and Bono played piano.
That's right. He did. He just showed up one night with little Stephen and the Edge.
Oh yeah.
And they hung out for hours.
And
it was just like that.
What about Shane now? What is it? Where is it? Or is it?
Oh, it's long gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's changed so drastically down there. Back then, you know, there was a lot of East Europeans living in the East Village. And, you know, they'd be living 10 and 12 to an apartment. And they all worked, if they worked, like in the restaurants and the bars. So they were out late at night. So you could play music late. But then when everything changed, you know, the rents went up. You had people wanted to get up early and they didn't want that carry on, you know. So it's really become quite gentrified by now.
What was the capacity? Was it like 300 or 400 or more?
Not at all. It was nothing like that. It probably seated 50 and we packed 100 in. Not even 100.
Wasn't there another place that you opened around the corner or something?
I opened a place two doors down called On Shaw.
Yeah.
And that place had no music whatsoever. No, it was a conversation place. And some people liked that idea. A lot of people liked it. Some people couldn't handle it. But I did it specifically because a lot of people were coming for the different musicians and bands that were playing, and they were bringing people down that could further their careers, you know. So rather than have them go off somewhere else, I gave them a place where they could, you know, continue their discussions as to what they wanted to do.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. Okay, well then let's just get back then finally to Jeff Buckley, Shane. Like Jeff Buckley as a bloke, as a guy, I would get the impression he was very much like not really ever searching for the spotlight, not the kind of guy who particularly wanted even record company interest, but to hell with it, if it was going to happen, it was going to happen. And he just wanted to play and do his own thing and learn.
That's absolutely right. You know, I mean, the whole thing caught me so much by surprise. Like, later on, I had all these people coming in from Australia and France and wherever wanting to know, is this where Jeff Buckley played? But I didn't remember it like that. Mm. Even after Grace was, you know, they started playing it in the movie theater. And he came in one day, he was all pissed off. He'd gone to the movies and he heard his music. And he didn't want that because that's where he lived. And his manager at the time said, Jeff, you know, get used to it. This is what's happening. But, you know, he did like when people liked what he was doing. But, you know, he didn't want to step in there also.
And I would get the impression, finally, just about the guy, that it was all about the performance and the song and the music and just getting lost in the moment. I mean, he didn't do an awful lot of moving around on stage. It was just, here is my art, this is what I do, and I'm not going to be hanging off the speakers like Bono might have been at the time with White Flags and stuff. Not that kind of stuff at all.
No. He was like, he was really obsessed with music. He was into all kinds of music. He walked around with a little mini boombox thing, and he constantly soaking up everything around him. And then he would try to blend that in because he was trying to find out, I guess, what was his thing, you know.
And did he really wash the dishes in Shanae, did he?
He did. But you know what? There was no backstage. You know, you had to go behind the counter and there was a sink there. So if you're back there and the sink is there, you may as well do the dishes while you're there, right?
Yeah,
so he'd drink a little wine and he'd do the dishes.
Yeah.
But he hung out there because, you know, every day he'd come by when he was around just to see what was happening, who was in town, because there were so many people and he was curious all the time who was around.
Yeah.
So, or then he ended up, you know, he'd spend hours in Anshaw with Tom Clark, ended up being the bartender in there, and he'd just talk for hours, music with him.
And Shane, how's New York treating you these days, all right?
That's great, yeah. No, I love it here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, listen, look, thanks a million for talking to us, Shane. Good man yourself, a good slice of history. Shane Doyle it is, Shane it was. Thanks, Shane. Good luck. Take it easy.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye.
Oh, am I just
Grace, is the album Lilac Wine 20 years ago released this day? That is Jeff Buckley, and Tanya's here. Just to get past that all again, in terms of other recordings, Tanya, where did we go? I mean, what was released and how posthumous and how good were they and collected together and all the rest?
Well, like I said, there was so many different, you know, legacy versions of Grace came out, but Sketches for My Sweetheart, The Drunk, came out in 1998, I think.
Yeah, what do you think?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it showed such great promise. And I think that was the most tragic part of it, that you kind of understood that this was a career that was going to go very, very far, and it was just cut off at the pass, you know. And I think that was the biggest tragedy of it. You know, it was lovely to get that last goodbye or whatever, but no, I just found it all very,
do you know
very
the way, like, every single band has ever done anything of their own, which is really great and all that. In the early days, it's always cover versions. The amount of folk people who did AC/DC at the beginning are bizarre, but all that kind of thing. Now, like, I mean, this is a kind of a first album, Grace, isn't it, really? Because one of the reasons being, well, look, there's a bunch of covers on it. That cover.
Yeah, and the Benjamin Britten Corpus Christi Carol, which, I mean, is such a spine
tingler. That's the Nina Simone one we just heard.
And Nina Simone. I mean, like, he absolutely adored female vocalists, like, you know, Nina Simone, Billie Holiday. I mean, it's all over Grace, you know, Edith Piaf, Patti Smith, you know, they're just, and even because he had that falsetto voice, you know, I think he leaned towards those singers.
And I mentioned Catel Kenny earlier, who I saw in Dublin at the Tivoli with him, but she, I think, did stuff in Sinead with him, I think, probably.
She did,
well.
And she sang at his funeral, in fact, you know.
Okay.
And she became a huge part of that sort of Dublin DIY scene then, you know, in the sort of late 90s,
time.
Early noughties.
The Flowers,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, Jeff, I mean, most singer-songwriters would pay direct debt, you know, to Jeff Buckley, you know, the sort of Glenn Hansard's Mark and, you know, Mundy, Gemma Hayes.
Do you think the extra stuff that was on any of the Grace re-releases kind of thing was worthwhile? I mean, obviously cashing in from Columbia point of view.
Well, exactly. I mean, it was just, they really were scraping the barrel, you know. I mean, to hear the live stuff was really beautiful because he sort of chatted in between his songs, and you realise that this was a man with a great sense of humour, you know. But he did talk a little bit about, you know, love and mortality, and that just gives it a whole different, you know, very sad significance, you know.
And does it bring you back to your bedsit student days?
I was never in a bedsit. Do you know what? This is what Dan and I were saying, you know. Dan Hegarty said, you know, this was an album very much of its time. It transports him back to his sort of adolescent years. But to me, this is an album that never died, and it's just totally timeless. I listened to it this week while writing the Independent piece, and it didn't transport me anywhere because it's never gone away. It's like sort of Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz, you know. It's never laid low enough for you to be transported.
Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz. I do exactly know what you mean. I hadn't thought of that before. All right, well, listen, Tanya, thanks a million for talking to us in the programme this morning. Tanya Sweeney from the Indo, Jeff Buckley, Grace, 20 years old today. And I might as well, the other one that's mentioned here, the most famous song on the album, which of course everybody who likes the album says, oh, it's not my favourite song, is a version of a Leonard Cohen song. And he was the first one to do this, so try not to think of X Factor and all that. So he wasn't the first. There was John Cale, there was Bono, there was loads of versions of this around. But it's a very famous song, and you have to hear the little breathing at the beginning. Hold on a second, here it goes. There, do you hear that? That was Jeff Buckley.